This is Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Meet Bess Samuel. One of her first jobs was a counselor at Space Camp in Huntsville, Alabama.
It was fun. It's pretty cool to put a simulated astronaut training on your resume.
As Bess told our own Justine Paradise, that is in fact where she met her husband.
So we're true nerds. We met at Space Camp. We got engaged at a Doctor Who convention.
Yes.
And now they have two kids. The older just started preschool this year. But these days, they're thinking about moving out of Alabama. She told us that it's hard because there's a lot of things about the South she really loves. But especially now that her son is in school, she's worried about the political and cultural climate in the state. It's more conservative and more religious than she'd like. But there's another reason, too. And this is the reason Bess initially reached out to us. She actually dialed into the Ask Sam hotline and left us a voicemail.
Hi, this is Beth in Huntsville, Alabama. My family and I are looking to move for a number of reasons, but one of them is because of climate change. Where is the safest place to move based on the data that we have right now?
This is way more personal of a question than we're used to getting for Ask Sam, which is why Justine called Bess back to follow up.
I feel like I have to be realistic about this is as good as it's gonna get for a while. Like we keep hearing these things about it's the hottest summer, and that trend doesn't seem to be reversing. So I look at the summers we have now, and I look at the $200 power bills and, you know, frying eggs on sidewalks. At this point, we're just trying to do better. But part of the problem is you don't know what things are going to look like in 10 years because everything is changing so rapidly.
There's a term for what Bess is thinking about doing: climate migration, relocating entirely or partly because of climate and climate change. And in the coming decades, the scale of climate migration could be somewhat dizzying. One analysis from ProPublica looked at what could happen in the worst-case scenario. In 50 years, 4 million people in the United States could find themselves living at the fringe, decidedly outside the ideal conditions for human life. 4 million. Imagine if even half of that number needed to move. And even now, Bess is not the only one asking this question.
The idea that, you know, you have to live in one place forever, I think people have to forget that.
Oh, there's like a haze in the sky, isn't there? And I'm like, yeah, dude, like, I need to go inside.
Where do we want to go? Because it's not enough to say, okay, I don't want to be here. Where are you going?
This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. Today, in collaboration with By Degrees, NHPR's climate reporting initiative, we're devoting the entire episode to answering one question. If you're worried about climate, where should you live?
We don't know what the next year is going to bring.
Are people moving already?
They see what's happening, right? Like, I'm being displaced.
And how should places prepare for the wave of climate migrants just around the corner?
So it worries me that, like, the predictable stuff is the tip of the iceberg.
So to answer this question, we have Justine Paradise, our producer on Outside In.
Yep, hello.
And energy environment reporter at New Hampshire Public Radio, Annie Ropeek. Hey.
Hello.
So can we answer Bess's question? Where is the safest place to live in the United States?
I think the real thing is, can you answer this question?
Oh. Well, to a certain extent, I feel like there's a straightforward answer to this. So in 2017, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, put out something called the Climate Resilience Screening Index. And it basically aggregated all sorts of climate risks and societal measures into just a single point-based score. And according to that, the most resilient county in the United States is the Kodiak Island borough of Alaska.
Oh, okay. There's the answer. Good luck, Bess. Have fun.
Have a great life.
End of episode.
I mean, one question is like whether most resilient is even the same thing as safest, right? But either way, this kind of goes to show how unsatisfying it can be to just go by the data to try to answer a question like this.
Right. And just to sort of underscore this, ProPublica did another one of these aggregation risk analyses and showed that some of the safest areas in 20 to 40 years, theoretically, will be parts of like the Midwest and parts of the Northwest and parts of northern New England, like Maine and Vermont.
So from Alabama to like the wintry mix of New England winters, right. Welcome, Bess.
Right. And not everyone who's facing sea level rise or wildfires is going to want to move to places like those. So when we got the idea to do an episode responding to Bess's question, we decided let's just put out a survey asking people how they're dealing with this question of where they should live based on climate change. And Justine, you actually reached out to some of the people who responded to that survey.
Yeah, I reached out to probably like 10, 12 people all over the country. And, you know, just like you were pointing to, Sam, everyone's individual situation was so different. Like there was Susie Patterson, who was living in Kailua Kona, Hawaii.
Anywhere you are, climate change is happening. It's getting worse. Why not pick where you want to live the most? And for us, it was Hawaii. It was a dream.
There was Alex, who was dealing with wildfire smoke in LA.
It's a constant balancing act between what things to do to the air in any given room to accomplish a habitable environment.
And there was Mike Haas, an organic vegetable farmer in Kentucky.
It gets super hot in June, July. I don't really grow potatoes anymore those times of year because it's just too hot.
But there was one story that I think in particular really illustrated just how idiosyncratic this whole decision is of figuring out where you're going to live in light of climate. And it came from someone named Jesse.
I'm Jesse Jaime. I live in San Antonio, Texas. And I'm currently a student, and I work at a warehouse for the moment until I finish college.
And Sam, you actually jumped on this call, too. Jesse is in school for biology right now.
Yes, and he's thrilled about biology. And when we were on the Zoom call, you could see the posters on the wall behind him. And there was like one that was just a bunch of fossils, and the other was like a giant map of Big Bend National Park.
Yeah. And Jesse really loves the desert, loves the American West. But one of the things he is considering as he thinks about where he's going to live in the future is his health.
Right. Because he's got asthma.
You know, at my age, people don't look at people who are like, you know, over like 18 or 20, you know, like in their higher, like they don't really think of asthma as like an adult, issue. You know, you even see it in like shows. It's like the people with asthma are like these like nerdy kids, you know, like they're always like wheezing. You know, they got that right, but whatever. Like, it stuck with me.
I love it, it's a true stereotype, but I resent it anyway.
Self-fulfilling.
Yeah, my asthma condition is, like, mild to severe. So I had an internship in Utah, and so I lived there for the summer, and it was in Glen Canyon. And the whole time I was there for those 2.5 months, I only used my inhaler once, and it was during a wildfire.
And he said, I think Jesse said that the only other time he used his inhaler that summer was when he visited LA to see his dad's family, and that usually he's using it all the time.
Like, I don't know if you've ever had, like you were, like, buried in the sand, and you, like, there's, like, a lot of sand, like, on your chest, so it's, like, harder to breathe. It feels like that. So that's what it feels like in the city, or, like, in an area with, like, bad air quality. And other people might not even notice it. They just might notice like there's like a haze in the sky, isn't there? And I'm like, yeah, dude, like I need to go inside. Like I can't do this.
And that means that living near wildfires is a much bigger deal for him. And as things get hotter, air quality, both in terms of city smog and wildfire smoke, will probably just get worse.
Right. And the other thing that happened in our conversation was that, you know, Jesse had told us, hey, I'm living with my grandfather and my mom. They both, you know, grew up and lived in a village in the high desert in Mexico.
Hola.
Hola, buenos días.
And he brought his mom in to talk with us too.
Mi nombre completo es Arelia Jaime Ramirez.
And we partly want to talk to her because they argue about how much can you really do about climate change. And I remember in this conversation asking her, like, hey, it seems that climate change is a really big deal for Jesse, and he thinks that we should be doing things personally to fight it, and that it's really impacting how he thinks about his future. And is that the case for you? And she had this very diplomatic response.
Yo pienso que sí, que eso es lo que él piensa, sí.
Where she just said, yes, I think that's what he thinks. and I was like, oh, but not you. And her answer was I think, like, a sentiment that is in a certain sense true, which is she said, like, my impact is so small, what can I do? And in the meantime, the people that are causing the problem are just polluting even more.
I mean, I think this just points to, like, how this is such a stressful emotional decision, and we're dealing with this massive collective action problem. We're all trying to figure out what it means for our own individual lives. But, you know, I think that process can bring up this kind of sense of, like, a loss of agency, of being out of control. And since we'll all be experiencing it no matter what or no matter where we are, maybe does it even make sense to move?
Well, actually, my takeaway from talking to Jesse and his mom, too, was the reasons people move are complicated and like interwoven together. And so Jesse is like a young dude. He's like just getting started in life. And he's thinking about this a lot, like, where do I want to make my life? Versus his mom, you know, she's like reached a certain point, and it was just clear she was not considering moving. Like she's noticing things are changing, but these are not considerations that are a big enough deal for her to uproot everything.
So that brings us to one of the reasons why looking up this data isn't exactly satisfying, because first of all, moving is like such a combination of so many factors. Lots of them are emotional factors, and also everyone's decision affects everyone else's decision. It's this butterfly effect. Like, how complicated would it be if thousands or even millions of people moved to Kodiak or like Coos County, New Hampshire, 2010 population 33,000?
I do find it kind of hard to imagine millions of people moving to Coos County, New Hampshire. But even like tens of thousands of people would be a huge deal.
And that's the wild thing, is you can't really know what to expect. That's the problem here. And then any one change in the system affects all the other changes. One disaster in one place will drive people to another place, which could drive people there to another place, and so it's this ripple effect.
And one of the places that scores pretty high in terms of climate resiliency is our neighbor, Vermont. And so, Annie, we sent you to find out if they were thinking much about climate migration. Like, is Vermont prepared for a big influx of people moving to that state?
The very short answer is that there's no good answer to it. It's like chicken and egg. And, you know, this is where we get to the inevitable COVID-19 tie-in, right? So you might have seen this kind of theme in maybe certain New York Times articles during the pandemic, like small rural town not too far from a major metro area struggles with an influx of wealthy second homeowners fleeing from COVID. We even did one of these stories here at NHPR. I went up to New Hampshire's Lakes region early in the lockdown in April, and literally the first people I met on the street in the town of Wolfboro were a male swimwear model and a Ralph Lauren executive from New York City who were hunkering down in their second home with their two Cocker Spaniels.
We're just grateful to be here. I think that not everybody is fortunate to be able to get out of the cesspool of New York right now, so...
That will never happen to me again in my career, that I just like stumble on just caricaturishly perfect.
Oh,
yeah.
God.
It was just astonishing.
I love that story.
I'm sure they were lovely, but
they were great, and they had people yelling at them because they had New York plates on their car.
Got a few looks.
Who let you out of the state? You know, things like that. It's been a mix.
So that is genuinely a microcosm of what could happen due to climate change, depending on how towns sort of plan on how to accept new residents. So take Vermont as an example. There are lots of people that have moved there semi-permanently due to the pandemic. It could be up to as many as 11,000 people, according to one research firm. And just for context, Vermont's population is 624,000 people. So that would be around 1.5% increase if that turns out to be true.
14 months ago, we wouldn't have anticipated a population bump due to a pandemic. So how can we sit here now and say that we won't see climate migration in a year or 5 years or 10 years?
This is Kate McCarthy. She's the Sustainable Communities Program Manager at the Vermont Natural Resources Council. And she was one of the first people in Vermont who really started thinking about climate migration in this context in just the past few years.
And we were met with some skepticism, for sure. Oh, that's not going to happen. There are no jobs here. People don't have any motivation to come here. And now I think with COVID, people have seen two things. One, you don't need to be coming to a job. You can be bringing a job with you. And two, we don't know what the next year is going to bring.
Kate has been trying to kind of normalize this conversation around climate migration, and it's really complicated, especially because, you know, what people like her are expecting is that the first wave of people who come are going to be upper middle class folks, people who kind of are able to move regardless of how Vermont prepares to accept them. And Kate has worked on this a lot with an attorney named Elena Mahaly. She works with the Conservation Law Foundation, which is a nonprofit up here, and she lives in Vermont.
I don't think Vermont has really faced the kind of development pressure that it may once other parts of our country become uninhabitable.
And Elena says, like, without some good planning, she's worried that rampant development will only serve to heighten inequality, to undermine Vermont's other goals, including around climate change. So by fragmenting forest lands, for example, or increasing transportation emissions, which are our biggest contributor to climate change up here. And Elena says they also don't want to see new housing built in river floodplains or additional stress on drinking water aquifers that are already sensitive to drought because, you know, this is the thing. We're not immune to climate change in New England. These things are going to happen. They're already happening. Just because we're safer than, like, California in wildfire season does not mean there won't be climate-related problems and challenges for current and new residents to deal with.
Including wildfires.
Including wildfires, exactly. We've seen forest fires in a drought this year. I've had a New Hampshire official tell me verbatim, it could happen here.
And it also just makes me think that, like, some of these things are oversimplifications. Mm-hmm. Like people will look at New England and they say, oh, that's a place that has abundant, drinking water.
Bingo.
But it's like, look at this year. We're still having a pretty crazy drought. People's wells have gone dry. Folks have had to drill new wells, which could be putting pressure on aquifers. And I just think some of the top line numbers oversimplify what it'll be like to live through climate change here in New England.
Right, yes. So short-term extremes are not the same thing as long-term abundance. But, you know, Elena says the good news is that making those plans means doing a lot of stuff she says towns should be doing anyway, right? So practically, it means creating a greater variety of housing types, more affordable housing, creating more support for rural infrastructure like water and sewer, expanded healthcare, education. And then Elena says it also means better zoning.
It's as much about the town saying, here's the development we want, as it is about the town saying, here's the development we don't want. So that there is something for them to fall back on besides instinct and bias and cultural norm when faced with a development or population influx.
So this is probably the toughest nut to crack. This is the culture clash issue. And
can I jump in really quickly with an anecdote?
Yes.
I visited a friend over the summer who lives in Vermont, and it was a birthday, and don't at me, it was outside. People wore masks whenever they came to the food table. Everyone was just sitting around a fire, you know. Anyway, but I met a friend of hers who grew up in Vermont, and they were all talking about how all these people were coming to Vermont. And there was just something she said that I just found totally chilling, where she goes, yeah, you know, all these people coming in, and I just hope they're the right people. Ooh. And I was like, you know, the New Hampshire person, just like my hackles went up a little bit. And and then, like, she went on, and, like, it turns out she was obviously just talking about Trump voters, which, you know, is a little bit of an eye roll in its own way. But
I mean, that's like, there's no good. I mean, I don't know. If you have to ask, I think
exactly.
There's just no good outcome to asking that
exactly.
question. At best, she means New Hampshire people.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, this is real.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, like, that's the real life version of these New York Times stories about, you know, traffic jams at the rural transfer station because of all the New Yorkers fleeing COVID who don't know how to drop off their recycling. Or, you know, we've also seen stories about, like, racial slurs being yelled at people of color with out-of-state plates on their cars, you know, who are driving around in towns where they have a second home. And it's important to remember that Vermont is shrinking and aging and overwhelmingly white.
Like, I can't emphasize enough, I think, how much energy is should be devoted towards the social issues that come with welcoming new people to Vermont, and the deep-seated nativism and sort of you're not a Vermonter unless you were born and raised here three generations ago notion. It's really time for us to see the opportunities that come from welcoming people into the state.
So I think it's been interesting for us to think about this from the perspective of New England states, because that's where we are. But I want to pull back a little more to see how this shapes how we'll live together kind of at a bigger scale, and how are entire communities and cities already changing.
Where is the safest place? I don't think there is that place that is completely safe. It depends on which asset you can deal with. There's always a trade-off, right?
Outside In, we'll be right back after a break. Welcome back to Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown, here today with Justine Paradise and Annie Ropeek. And today we have been talking about climate migration in the United States. Basically, there are going to be millions of people who are increasingly at risk from climate-related problems, flooding, extreme heat, crop failure. And that means that potentially millions of people might be picking up and moving somewhere safer over the next few decades. But where and what place isn't so affected by climate change?
So far we've been talking about New England and a few individual stories of people who are trying to make decisions in their own lives. But then I talked to this researcher who's really focused on change at a societal level.
My name is Jola Jibade. I am an assistant professor at Portland State University.
So Jola focuses a lot on cities. And a big question she asks is, can different kinds of movement driven by climate change happen in ways that are just and fair? And Jola herself is originally from Lagos, Nigeria, and grew up in a part of the city that flooded a lot. And this was even before climate change was such a serious factor.
So I grew up in a community called Ijeshatedo in Lagos. But it was built in, the old Ijeshatedo at the time was a swampland.
And because they lived on the ground floor,
we got flooded every time it rained.
And that experience really follows her to this day, even just as far as living on the first floor.
Even if it didn't get flooded, it was just the fear. I hated living on ground floor. Even to date, I don't like it.
So in the course of her work, Jola had been noticing that people and policymakers were conflating what she says are very different types of movement. Climate migration versus managed retreat.
And I was just infuriated. I was saying, no, the people who are retreating are not the same people who are migrating. Of course, you can retreat and migrate, but these are different things, and it's not helping move us forward.
The way she defines it, climate migration is what we've been talking about so far. Even if it's at a massive scale, like even if people feel like they have no choice but to leave, climate migration really tends to focus on individual people and families.
And then with managed retreats, people are thinking we can move lighthouses. We can move the capital of a city. We can move our businesses. We can move all of these things. And so it's very different in terms of the ways in which it plays out on ground.
Managed retreat is about planning. It can be more collective. It can be more or less government or institutionally supported. It can be more or less strategic. So like moving buildings or buying people out in New Jersey after Hurricane Sandy, or moving entire communities together. So you can think of those recent case studies you might have heard about, like coastal native communities in Shishmaref, Alaska, or Ile de Jean Charles in southern Louisiana. So lots of examples, but Jola says they are not all created equal.
What does it mean for retreat to be successful? I haven't seen a situation where all of the aspects of human life to date can be said to be a win-win.
A win-win can be really hard to achieve, and some managed retreats can be super top-down and not participatory. So like there are buyouts in the case of Hurricane Sandy in New Jersey, but in Lagos, Jola says there are examples that didn't provide any compensation for moving.
So I call that a kick out instead of a buyout.
Yeah, and there was this other example in Manila that she studied of the restoration of this river that had been declared biologically dead. And that did give people funding and built housing and got buy-in.
And so some of the slum dwellers themselves became environmental justice advocates, or should I say they became environmental practitioners and people were saying we need to protect the river, because they were engaged, actively engaged from the beginning.
So the thing is, this took 20 years, so time was a factor in that one. And there's another example in Manila that Jola also told me about. This is the example of New Clark City, which is a totally new city right now being constructed outside of Manila.
They are putting in place rail lines, housing, sports centers. So they are building the city from the scratch, and the goal is that it will be completed in 20 years.
The idea behind New Clark City is that when disasters hit Manila, the people that need to respond are also affected and therefore can't help.
They all live there, so they all get impacted. So the idea is if you move them to Clark City, if there is a major issue, they can fly with a helicopter and whatever else, then they can help people in Manila to deal with it. That's part of the logic for this New Clark City. But I don't know if, you know, the people, informal settlers' families, low-income classes, will also be part of the people that will be relocated to New Clark City.
So like she said, Jola wasn't sure how this will play out and if it's going to be equitable or not.
I guess I'd just say that, you know, there's no guarantee that it will or won't be equitable. But according to people I've talked to, that if you only try to make it fair while the change is already underway, it's kind of too late. Like, if you don't plan for change to be equitable, you can almost guarantee that it won't be.
So actually, there's another iconic example of how movement due to climate change is happening within one city in the United States. And this is an example that demonstrates how equity and history and climate change are all interacting, and how climate change puts more pressure on top of what's already taking place. And this city is Miami.
Yes, I was born and raised in Miami, 305 till I die, like born and raised in the county of Dade. So like this is home for me.
This is Nadege Green. She works for the Community Justice Project in Miami. And she reported on climate gentrification for the local public radio station, WLRN. So in Miami, there is this limestone ridge that runs north-south through the city. And this is where the railroad tracks were built, on top of the ridge. So east of the railroad is the ocean and lower elevation, the waterfront. So it's historically quite desirable.
And the neighborhoods immediately west of that ridge tend to be historically Black neighborhoods. So for example, Little Haiti and Liberty City are west of the ridge and they sit on higher elevation.
So higher elevation with projected sea level rise. Elevation is obviously one of the factors that will accelerate investment and development and rising property prices in places like Liberty City and Little Haiti. And Nadege was careful to say this is not the only thing. Like, people are still actively buying waterfront property in Miami.
Insanely, yeah.
I know. But Liberty City in particular was really like founded by a Black community that was displaced earlier in the 20th century by urban renewal and specifically the construction of I-95, the highway. You know, and this happened up and down the East Coast and across the country. Mm-hmm. Highway planning, directing highways specifically through Black communities. So earlier, displacement came disguised under phrases like urban renewal, and now words that you hear a lot.
You'll hear terms like smart planning.
And the question is this just the same thing under a different name? Like, is this a familiar pattern?
They see what's happening, right? Like, I'm being displaced. Like, I have to move. My rent is going up.
Some would call this not just gentrification, but climate gentrification. So Nadege herself was born in Little Haiti, and she's of Haitian descent. She grew up in and around the neighborhood, and she's seen old residents move out. And one thing we talked about was cultural loss.
When we talk about displacement, it can feel very like, okay, people were moved to somewhere else and the end. But we don't really like delve into like how displacement impacts folks, right? Like the emotional impact, the psychological impact of leaving your community or not being able to call home the community you've always called home.
And the shift of the neighborhood is especially acute for, you know, older folks. Nadege pointed out people on fixed income, maybe Social Security, in a city with just like really high rents in a lot of it.
Like, what does it mean to have a neighbor that knows that Madame Pierre lives upstairs? And, you know, when she doesn't feel well, like I can make the tea that, you know, the Haitian tea from this bush that, you know, we drink when we have a stomach ache, right? Like, who will check on Madame Pierre when the neighborhood shifts?
Impermanence might be the new normal for many of us. And so, you know, the idea that, you know, you have to live in one place forever, I think people have to forget that. It's not happening. That's the truth. I mean, I think people who have been able to do that historically, I think it's a privilege that they should celebrate. I mean, in my case, even as a Nigerian who moved abroad, there are a lot of issues in my country that led me to decide to move abroad. But I would have preferred to stay back if things were fine. And so I sort of have in my head that that nothing is permanent. I guess that's how I live my life.
One thing that she said, like, Portland is going to experience this earthquake at some point, this 9.0 earthquake. And she's like, I know it's going to happen. It's always in my head.
But I have to say that I'm not afraid because I've had to leave my family. I've had to go to many countries. I'm living in a foreign country. This is not new to me.
Years ago, I read this piece about, it was about exile and identity, and it was written by different people who were, and you know, there are so many different terms of expat or immigrant or migrant or refugee, like, and so political, but it's by Charles Simic, and he said, you know, he had been displaced, and he said he would walk in the streets, and the streets were full of these somebodies putting on confident airs. Half the time I envied them, half the time I looked on them with pity. I knew something they didn't, something hard to come by unless history gives you a good kick in the ass. How superfluous and insignificant in any grand scheme mere individuals are, and how pitiless are those who have no understanding that this could be their fate too.
I've never read that before, but that's exactly how I feel. And that's exactly what I think many people are going to come to understand and perhaps experience. It does something to you. You see people as people. You know, you get some opportunities because you move, you lose some things, but, you know, but it gives you that sense of resilience, individual resilience, if you want. But some other people, this is going to affect them psychologically because they've never had to do this. And climate change is going to make a lot of people become exposed to the psychological and all other types of impact that comes with impermanence.
Hey.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Where is the volume?
So, at long last, Justine gave Bess a call back.
You ready for an answer?
Yes. Where should I go run and hide from the storms, winds, tornadoes, other assorted bad nature things?
First, with the straight up EPA answer.
So what do you think about moving to Kodiak Island, Alaska?
I don't think my partner would be into it, but I might be. I don't know. How's the internet access in Kodiak Island, Alaska?
There's the next on the list is Juneau, and then Ketchikan, Alaska, and then Sitka, Alaska. Okay. Are you getting the picture?
Okay. I don't know if I could sell Alaska though. That's a long. I don't know. That would be interesting.
Do you have top contenders for options?
Colorado is high on the list. I did look into New Hampshire because you guys made it sound pretty good. I don't know how I would feel about the primary season, though. That would probably be not my favorite.
Our first in the nation.
Yeah. And also the diversity is kind of an issue up there. I like the scenery a lot, but being an interracial family... it just gives me pause.
A real answer is really like not an answer. Like this only, you know, like the data only gets you so far. And like this will sound obvious, but like this, the people we talked to basically said like it depends on your priorities and what trade-offs you're willing to deal with.
Yeah, there's no solutions. There's only trade-offs.
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly it. I hope you let us know what you decide to end up doing.
Yeah, I'll let you guys know. Yeah, and if, I mean, you'll definitely hear about it if we do end up in New Hampshire somehow.
All right, I'm going to go put this in the episode, so.
Oh, okay.
I'll see you later.
Oh, okay. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
That was Justine Paradise with me, Sam Evans-Brown, and NHPR's environmental reporter, Annie Ropeek.
You can hear more of NHPR's climate reporting project by degrees by just going to nhpr.org/climate. So, another segment of Outside In with no clear answers. Kind of familiar at this point if you're a regular listener. And on that theme, we are going to be jumping into another complicated ecological narrative after the break, reintroducing the wolf. That's when Outside In continues. Welcome back to Outside In. I'm Sam Evans-Brown. It's been a little more than a month since the election, and we're still sorting through all of the fallout from that day in November. So you'd be forgiven if you missed a ballot measure that was up for consideration in Colorado. In what critics have called ballot box biology, voters narrowly passed an initiative calling on the state to reintroduce wolves. There were plenty of arguments in favor. Biodiversity generally is a thing we value. Wolves in Colorado would create a continuous wolf population from Canada all the way down to Mexico, and
humans deliberately wiped out wolves in Colorado, as they did in most of the lower 48 states. And so we have a moral responsibility to restore the species.
That's Sharon Levy, who this spring wrote a piece for Undark magazine digging into one other argument for reintroducing wolves that has had a bit of a moment in what we might call the pop science world.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The wolves changed the behavior of the rivers.
That's George Monbiot, a British journalist and activist, laying out the idea of a trophic cascade. It's the concept that reintroducing top predators can have beneficial effects that cascade all the way down the food chain, impacting even the landscape itself.
The rivers changed in response to the wolves.
But, as Sharon Levy found, the evidence tying wolves to whole-scale healing of landscapes is much murkier than certain TED Talks and viral YouTube videos might lead you to believe. So for starters, what is a trophic cascade? Where did this idea come from?
A trophic cascade is an ecological process wherein a top predator controls an ecosystem and shapes an ecosystem through its impact on its prey. And back in, say, the 1960s, this was a really radical idea in ecology.
And this was shown with sea otters and sea urchins in the sort of northern Pacific, right?
Well, there was a researcher named Robert Payne who worked with the intertidal zones in around Seattle. And what he did was he went out to the intertidal zones and he marked out grids. And in some parts of his grids, he just picked out all the starfish, which are predatory creatures. And he just kept going back on a regular basis, pulling out all the starfish in these grids. And what he found over time was that in the areas where all the starfish were removed, the biodiversity collapsed because the starfish preyed on mussels, and when there's no starfish, the mussels just proliferate and outcompete everything else. And where there were starfish, you had much more diversity of species. And then based on Payne's work, a guy named James Estes started to study sea otters in Alaska. Sea otters had been wiped out by fur hunters. And as they began to return to some islands in Alaska, Estes saw that as the otters returned, they preyed on sea urchins. And when the urchin population was cut down, all this biodiversity came back. Kelp grows and all these species that feed and shelter on kelp show up. So those are pretty dramatic examples.
So then let's talk about the reintroduction of wolves to Yellowstone. Why did biologists start looking for evidence of a trophic cascade? And did they find evidence of a trophic cascade in process?
Yes, they did. Or they at least believed they did, but wolves had been missing completely from Yellowstone for something about 70 or 80 years. And the other top predators, like grizzlies and cougars, their populations were very depleted. So this was a place that had been lacking in top predators for a long time. And a pattern that people were observing all over Yellowstone, especially on the northern range, was that trees like aspens and willows had stopped growing. There was such an overpopulation of elk, and the elk like to munch on aspen and willow, that places where there had been, you know, big tall aspens and willows, the trees were basically little stubby stumps that were eaten down to the nub. And as the wolves began to return, scientists saw some regrowth of this aspen and willow. And so there, some people extrapolated that to say, well, this is because of the wolves. But it turns out, after years of studying the situation and picking it apart, that it's much more complicated than that.
It's much more complicated than that because this isn't a controlled experiment, right? Reintroducing wolves is not the only thing that's happening on that landscape.
That's exactly right. There are a number of other things going on. In the early years of wolf reintroduction, there are researchers who have looked at the data from that time in the 90s and shown that most of the decline in the elk population was due to human hunters who were hunting right outside the boundaries of the park. And of course, an elk doesn't know where the park boundary is. So the overall elk population was strongly affected by human hunters. Another factor was that there was a very harsh winter that knocked back the elk population. There's another factor, which is that cougars and grizzlies had a rebound of their populations all at the same time. And cougars prey on elk, especially calves, and grizzlies prey on elk calves. And so all these things affect the elk population.
So I think what I found really interesting about your article and what I'd like to dig into is like, what is the danger of relying on the argument that wolves will cause a trophic cascade? What, you know, and you spoke to a biologist,
Dave Meech. Yeah.
Meech. Yeah. So you spoke with Dave Meech, and he expressed a certain amount of unease about this idea. And I wonder if you could tell us why.
Well, Meech is very interesting because he has this long history of studying wolves and dealing with people who are reacting to wolves. He says that people have now, they're in danger of sanctifying the wolf, of seeing the wolf as this sort of saintly animal that has the power to repair damaged ecosystems. And it's a nice idea, but it's not accurate. One of the comments he made to me is that he thinks the best argument for restoring wolves is that a majority of people think we should have wolves in our ecosystems and want to bring them back. He says that's the most important argument in his view. But there was another ecologist, Tom Hobbs, from Colorado State University, who said to me, it's really pretty simple. The effects of bringing wolves back are not symmetric with the effects of having removed them in the first place. There's so much change on the landscape that wolves can't put it all back in place.
I guess based on the research that you were reading for this article and the researchers that you interviewed, if you were to guess what the impact on the landscape and the ecosystems of Colorado will be once they have a thriving wolf population, what would you guess?
I'm not an expert on Colorado ecosystems. Don't ask me that question. We could go more into some of the complexities of the changes that wolves can't fix on their own, or why they can't fix it on their own.
Well, sure. So what do you mean by that?
Well, one of the most studied changes is that as wolves disappeared and the other top predators disappeared, beaver were also lost, because here's the chain reaction of removing the top predators. You remove the top predators, elk become very overpopulated and overabundant, and they eat up all the willow. And when they eat up all the willow, beavers can't survive, and beavers are major engineers of the landscape, and they're native to all of North America. But they were hunted for their furs, and that really knocked their populations back. And even in protected places like Yellowstone National Park, they really almost completely disappeared. And the final blow to them was that they couldn't find willow, which they use as a food source and they use to build their dams. So you lose the top predator, you get overpopulated elk, you lose the willow, you lose the beaver. Now, when the beaver disappear, the whole course of rivers and streams changes, because beaver dams hold water back and keep the water table high. That means the water that's underground is close to the ground surface. And that's the condition that willows need to grow. So once you've lost the willows and then lost the beavers, a lot of streams that were dammed and held back by beaver dams, the dams disappear and the streams start to run fast and just cut deep into the earth. And so where you had kind of shallow spread out water, you now have streams that are incised really deep into the landscape. And willows can't grow there because the water table is too far down for their roots to reach. So you could bring wolves back, but wolves alone aren't going to allow beaver to repopulate to what they were before we messed the whole system up.
It's almost, you know, the sort of like idea that the wolf is the sacred animal. Even the beaver, it seems like, is not the sacred animal, right? It really does require a lot of different species, including and like the bit about hunters reducing elk populations makes me feel like, you know, even people are part of that landscape.
Oh, very much so. I mean, we're the elephant in every ecosystem on the planet, and that very much includes Yellowstone National Park. Wolves have tons of charisma, and it's been a long time now, but I've been to Yellowstone and been able to go to places. You know, I had the great privilege one time of going out to a recently abandoned wolf den with Doug Smith, the leader of the Yellowstone Wolf Project. That's like a total peak experience. Even though the wolves were gone, you know, you could see all the sticks that the puppies chewed on, and there was an elk carcass there. And also, if you ever get the chance to go in the Lamar Valley in Yellowstone, that's the easiest place to see wolves. And it's absolutely a lifetime high to stand there and watch wolves running around being wolves. It's they're totally awesome. And so are beaver. Beaver are incredible animals. But they are parts of systems. And even though beaver, you know, beaver are ecosystem engineers, and they do have these huge impacts. Wolves do too. But if you take the whole system apart, I think it's a complicated business to try to bring it back together again.
Sharon Levy, thank you so much.
Thank you for calling me.
Sharon Levy is a freelance journalist based in Humboldt County, California. Hey, everybody. Usually, this is a time of year where, in New England anyway, our instinct to hibernate offers a cozy change of pace. Blankets, hot cocoa, a roaring fire. Sadly, the pandemic sort of makes it feel like we've been hibernating all year. And even though it's only December, I suspect a lot of you out there are already feeling the February fidgeties. The good thing is, podcasts are a very safe way to experience the big wide world. You don't even have to stop knitting that sweater to enjoy them. So let's strike a deal. When you and 99 other Outside In fans donate to the show in any amount, we'll do the exploring for you. We're going to produce an extra episode of our series, 10 by 10, and we'll even let you vote between four possible topics. You can send us out to learn about life under the snow and sand of a winter beach, get a sneak peek inside a bird's nest, look for a secret ecosystem inside city gutters, or cut into the layers of an alpine snowpack. When you support Outside In, you help us explore the world. And when we explore the world, we take you with us. So give now at outsideinradio.org. It doesn't matter how much you give. What matters is that you show us you're listening. Give and vote at outsideinradio.org. And thanks so much for your support. It means a lot. This episode was produced by Justine Paradise, Annie Ropeek, Taylor Quimby, and me, Sam Evans-Brown, with support from Corey Princell and Todd Bellamy Walker. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is director of It Could Happen Here. Thank you to Anna Morandi, Chris Campany, Lauren Gaudette, and Garrett Neff. And thanks to everybody who responded to our climate migration survey and to everyone we spoke with for this episode. Today's music came from Massimo Ruberti and Blue Dot Sessions. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.